Armchair Sports Talk. Hey, guys, did Auburn win?
Overcooked.
This is Armchair Sports Talk. I'm your host, Eric Dorsch. We are joined in studio today by Russ Ivanek.
Hey, how's it going?
On the phone, we got D.O. Pauly Rowe.
Hey, what's up, guys?
And unfortunately, Sergeant Salty couldn't be here today. He had to stay at home, be a parent, which no one blames him for, but we're going to give him our time for it anyway. So right now, our boy Justin Marcus is probably sitting in the middle of his living room with face paint on, dressed as Elsa from Frozen.
Do you want to build a snowman? Come on.
Why are you the way that you are?
So, but anyway, we're going to get into Detroit sports the last week. Our Red Wings played the other night and didn't look too terrible. Our Detroit Lions played about a week ago and looked very terrible. And we're going to discuss a little bit of injuries over the last week. The Pittsburgh-Cincinnati Bengals game was quite a messy one, to say the least. So we're going to cover all that today. But first, let's lead off with our Red Wings. Guys, they play the Winnipeg Jets the other night, and I don't remember the exact score, but they won 5-1. Our statistician, Russ, is telling me 5-1. They won in pretty decisive fashion. Now, my question to you, is this a sign of good things, or is this more a sign of the Red Wings just playing a not-as-good team as well and capitalizing on the moment? Russ?
I think it's just capitalizing on the moment. I mean, it's a streaky team. We're going to win some games we shouldn't. We're going to lose some games we shouldn't. I mean, we just took advantage of it. You can't lose them all, right? So I'm hoping we've got some kind of magic against St. Louis coming in, but St. Louis is a great team. They've been bad the last 10 games, St. Louis has, so maybe we catch them on an off night. But, yeah, we just got lucky one night. Can't lose them all.
Which, I mean, that also speaks to the Calgary game a couple weeks ago. We don't score 8 goals ever.
No.
So, Paulie, what about you?
Yeah, I totally agree with Russ. I think it was just an in-the-moment kind of thing. You know, we were the kids who were acting up badly in church last Sunday, and then, you know, Coach was scolding us to act better this time, and we played better this time. But I don't think that really says anything about how we're going to play in our game coming up against St. Louis. I think that they're going to really stick it to us, and I think we're just going to go back to our old habits.
All right. So something I feel like we haven't seen a lot this year, Abby lit the lamp, and he did it in kind of ticky-tack fashion. I mean,
it was
off the goalie,
goal.
Nice little, which you expect from Abby, but I just feel like a lot of times this year we have not been saying Abby lights the lamp, which is a weird thing.
But what I have seen him do, and I actually like this is where he's used best offensively, almost every goal highlight that I watch that he's on the ice for, he is within a foot and a half of the top of the crease. Nyquist scores on the power play. Abby's got his butt out in front. That one, it was a deflected puck that he gathered up, put in. I think the Nyquist goal later on, Abby was in front of the net as well. I mean, that's where he lives. I'm not a big fan of how much we're paying him to do it, but he's doing it effectively at least, so it's harder to make fun of him.
Yeah, exactly. You don't really want to pay the money we're paying for a wall, but at the same time,
he's producing at least.
Well, but at the same, and I don't know what his contract was when we had him, but at the same time, we had a wall in front of our team for 20 years by the name of Homer, and he kind of made our team monumentally better. So, I mean, if it leads to wins and it leads to offensive production the way it did and the way it could, I'm all for it. I mean, he'll never be the highest-paid player on our team. He shouldn't even be remotely close to the highest-paid player on our team. But if he's out there helping, Abby, to me, seems like someone who, when we first got him, we were hoping for, like, the Nyquist-Tatar production out of him, and it never really came about. He's able to contribute offensively, but he seems to me like somewhere along the road he kind of embraced there's much more talented guys around me. I'm going to do the little things, kind of like a little more offensively gifted Darren McCarty, the guy who's never going to be the most gifted, but he'll do everything he can to get that team a W. And Abby seems to be embracing that role. I mean, he's not afraid to get in the other guy's face, get a little scrappy with him, not afraid to get out in front of the net and take some wicked slap shots.
Well, yeah, that's what Datsuk used to say about him is, you know, I'm going to go out here and be the skilled guy, and somebody's got to pull the piano. And he tagged Abby as that guy. And I mean, Abby had a 20-goal season because of it, because he was sitting there with Datsyuk and just banged home the ugly ones.
Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that.
Sounds like a weird Saturday night, but Abby's made a career out of it.
But we've also seen me play hockey, and we know that's all I can do is bang home the ugly ones. So
that's fair.
There's no shame in that.
Or shoot the slowest slap shot ever, so slow that Paul didn't even want to touch it. He just wanted it to scare the goalie.
It actually stopped. It took a water break.
Exactly.
And hey, in that moment... Going. In that moment, I thought that we were just playing curling.
Oh, well.
That explains why you were screaming
yeah,
at the puck.
That really did. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Paul.
I was just saying, you know, you didn't tell me to sweep, but I just let it go.
Hey.
It went in the net.
All right, perfect. Now, I didn't see this goal, so I need someone to give me a little bit on it. Darren Helm scored a goal for the Detroit Red Wings.
On a breakaway.
That's not possible. You're lying.
That's
this
the important piece of info.
People, that's false news. We do not report false news here.
It happened.
I apologize. As Justin said, correct news or I will expose you.
No, it was...
All right, Russ, go ahead.
So, it was a bad giveaway by Winnipeg's defense. Okay. It might have been Buffalo. I don't exactly remember. Tried to make a cross-ice pass, got deflected, and Helm took off with it from about the blue line in, had a breakaway. And shot a puck right up over the shoulder for a goal. He scored on a breakaway. That never happens with him. He's got the speed to get a bunch of breakaways. And throughout his career, he's gotten a ton of opportunities
there. So many.
He just doesn't bury them as often. It was exciting to see.
I know I've said this to you multiple times, and I know I've mentioned it to Jay as well. If you could get a point for hitting the goalie on the logo of their pads... Helm would lead the league in scoring every year because every time, doesn't matter. The goalie doesn't have to move. The goalie just stands in the middle in the crouch position, and it goes off the pads every time. So to hear he scored a goal, and I saw the text on a breakaway, I didn't believe you at first, but it appears that there's evidence to support it. So, yeah. Paul, Darren Helm, is this someone that we have kind of grown to the point that we don't really expect a lot of offensive production out of him? He's more of just a quick guy, get out on the break and, you know, try to facilitate?
Well, what he did in the game was pretty much the theme that the Detroit Red Wings have, and that is Helm, he did what he was supposed to do. Normally he gets on the breakaway and we all have that, you know, expectation that he's just going to miss. And by miss, we mean like hit it right straight into the goalie. But he got a breakaway and scored, and that was just kind of the theme of the night, that we're actually doing the things that we should be expected to do and actually do. And so, you know, for him to finally do it, it's kind of like, you know, I know we talked about it's probably just going to be a temporary thing, and, you know, because next breakaway, I'm sure he'll just go back to his old ways. But, you know, it at least was good for the day. Hopefully they can find ways to do that in the future. But, you know, I'm happy to see Helm do what he's supposed to be doing.
Exactly. No, that's great. So the other night, Nyquist lights the lamp twice.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he's a guy that I've always been big on. I know every time we talk about our young talent, I always put his name in there because, I don't know, there's something about him that it's streaky to say the best.
Yeah.
But he shows flashes of being able to do everything you want a guy. I always said that he kind of reminds me of a younger Zetterberg. He grinds with the puck. You know, he doesn't seem to get too overexcited, and he tries to make plays where plays are. And I have him on my fantasy team, and the last couple of weeks, I can't find a reason to drop him. Every week, I get ready to sign someone, and he's the guy. It's like, eh, okay, time to get rid of Nyquist. Oh, no, Nyquist has 3 goals in the last 2 nights.
Right.
He's not going to. So I'll ask this to Paul first. Is Nyquist kind of starting to maybe work his way into the role we kind of always expected out of him?
Well, you know, you're asking that about another one of our players who's pretty streaky. So, you know, if we had a category for our fantasy league of post-hit, I guess he would probably be a good person to pick up for that because he seems to get the almost goals as well. So he's kind of like what Helm is for, you know, the even strength, I guess you could say, because Helm tends to get his breakaways, you know, shorthanded. But yeah, for Nyquist, you know, I want to see him do a lot more than this. I think we're expecting a lot more goals than what he does have because, you know, I think Mantha and Larkin are really our front runners still. But, you know, Nyquist has yet to completely, you know, steal my heart for hopes that he's going to continue to do that.
Right. And the only thing I'd say to that is as far as hoping he's going to do more, I mean, he's 28. I think we used to hope that he would develop to be more, but I don't know.
That's
how
a good
much,
point.
Yeah, I don't know how much we can really expect him to grow past this, being that he's 28, he's been around for a bit. Yeah, to steal it from Justin, we overcooked him a little in the minors before we actually brought him up and gave him a solid chance. But it's really, he is what he is at this point. The knock's never been talent. The knock has been that he disappears at times offensively and just doesn't show up to that 30-goal talent that it looked like he had at the beginning of his career.
Speaking of old, we have Ken Holland, whose antics over the last couple of years have started to get pretty old. And we saw the other night that the Red Wings made a trade, not be it all monumental, but we traded Wilson.
Yep.
For a sixth-round pick.
Fifth-round pick.
And with that, the Red Wings have acquired now double-digit trade spots for the next 2 years. The questions I got to ask is, A, do we think we've got enough trade value, like enough trades, picks to make it valuable for us? But two, is it something we're even remotely excited about? Because there's a chance we're not going to see any of these players we draft until our kids are in elementary school, and none of us have children except for the one who's not here right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, but if we go by him, I mean, his kids will be in elementary school like next year, so yeah, I'll be excited about the picks if they show up then.
Yeah, they'll bring Dan Cleary up for that one.
Oh, Danny Cleary Hockey School. The nice thing about the Wilson trade, there's a nice bit of symmetry for our OCD fans out there. We got him in the Sheehan trade, okay, where we gave up Sheehan and a fifth for Wilson and a third. Well, we just shipped Wilson out for a fifth, so we got our fifth back.
Okay.
So it just turns into a Sheehan for a third swap, right? So that worked its way out, and we have almost all of our draft picks back.
Sheehan worth a third? Wasn't he the guy who had one goal all the year before?
We got a third for him.
Oh, okay, that's true. Yeah. Okay, so we got the value there. My bad.
He did
my
good
bad
there. Yes, I mean, and that, to your point, that's we have 2 third-round picks next year, 2 second-round picks, and our own first-round pick, which I am a little excited about, actually, mm-hmm, to answer your question, because it's going to be one of the highest ones we've had in a while. I was excited for the 9th overall pick that we had. Now I'm not too excited that we used it on Rasmussen, who just seems to be a big, slow center that might be a third or fourth line guy sometime. But this is supposed to be a deeper draft this next year. So having 5 picks in the first 3 rounds in a deep draft, I can buy a little bit of optimism there because, well, I'm not getting any optimism anywhere else.
No, not at all. Paulie?
Yeah, you know, with all these picks, we can hope that we can find our next Zetterberg or Datsyuk deeper into the draft like we did before. That's not to say that we will. I just hope that we can because we had that potential before. So, you know, I'm just hoping that Ken Holland and all of our scouts are doing their homework to be able to use those picks appropriately and wisely. Because, you know, we kind of have some needs out there, which I want to say everything, but more specifically, you know, I think we should kind of find another goalie to start overcooking, perhaps. I don't know. But, you know, start using those picks appropriately, get the guys that we can finally use and need and hope that we can find our next superstars. You know, I'm excited for it. And, yeah, I hope it will happen.
Yeah, it would be nice for them to actually go after a goalie and really bring him up. I think we drafted Philip Larsson a couple of years ago. He just got named to the Swedish Junior Olympics team. So, hey, maybe we've got something going there, but you can never have enough good goalies.
I mean, I don't disagree at all. And right now we don't have great goalies in the NHL. So to get some, you know, some young talent, we potentially get into Grand Rapids next year or two, who knows what we can get out of them, would be great. I think I'm channeling a little bit of Salty Spooky right now because I can't lie, I don't have a lot of optimism here. I mean, one, we find the talent, we just, again, using overcooking, we overcook them a lot. And I just feel like sometimes we completely overlook what we really need for, you know, what looks the most appealing. And I brought it up to Justin, you know, if the Red Wings got like a top 3 pick, which they're probably not going to, but if they did, would Ken Holland even know the right thing to do with that? We've all said defense. That's where, I mean, goalie too, but defense, we have no good young defensemen right now.
No.
We have none. DeKaiser didn't pan out. Let's be honest. No. He didn't. I like Ouellette, but I don't see enough in him to go, oh, yeah, let's start banking. Let's start.
If he was going to be a top-pairing guy, it would have started to show up by now.
Exactly.
He would have forced his way in.
Mike Green's not exactly ancient, but let's be honest, Mike Green's not going to dominate the league for the next 15 years.
I don't expect him to be back next year either.
Yeah.
Making $6 million is the last year of his deal.
Yeah. So it's just one of those things. I'm sorry, Paul. Go ahead.
Oh, it's okay. I mentioned a couple of podcasts ago that I really liked Nick Jensen, but after seeing how he played in the Montreal game where he looked like Bambi out there, basically falling down, you know, it looks like he still has some cooking to be had. You know, there's still a lot of growth that he needs to be done. So, yeah, I think defenseman would be a great route to go down for picks, is for sure.
You know what, Paul, as a defenseman, Bambi legs isn't the worst thing, okay? Like, sometimes you just got to get a little jello leg going, you know, wakes you up a little bit, okay? I make my living on jello leg defense.
You are the most offensive defenseman that I've ever seen, and I don't mean that in the way that you're trying to score goals.
I have two goals in 10 seasons of playing hockey with you people.
It offended me, you playing defense, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh,
if I had a dollar for every time all of us said, Eric, come back.
Hey,
we love you, Bambi.
Who knows? Ken Holland might draft yet.
I couldn't hurt this team, let's be honest.
Put your name in the draft pool, see what happens.
I couldn't hurt this team, I suppose. So, all right, well, that's probably going to do it for Red Wings. So now let's move on to, the Detroit Lions. And, guys, there was so much positive with that Red Wings game, and then now we have to switch over to so much negative. Our Detroit Lions fall 44-20 to the Baltimore Ravens, which I would like to point out is a team that has one of the worst offenses in the NFL, and they put up 44. Now, granted, they had a pick six on us, so that factors in. A pick six against our backup quarterback because Stafford hurt his hand. So you got to take that with a little bit of the grain of salt because it's not as big. But still, there's no reason that a team like that should be putting up that many points on us. And on the flip, that we shouldn't be more, you know, accurate with the football and scoring. I mean, our biggest highlight was a 33-yard run by Teon Green. And I just got to ask, guys, I mean, is it time to finally throw in the chips and start hopping on the bandwagon for next year?
As far as giving up on this year and playoff hopes? Yeah. Oh, yeah, I was ready 2 weeks ago. I'm done. Put it in the dumpster. I started watching that game. We go down 17-0, and I did the only sane thing that I could think to do. I walked over to my thermostat. I turned off the heat to my apartment. I grabbed a stick and a marshmallow, and I heat my entire apartment and this nice little marshmallow over the dumpster fire that is the Detroit Lions. I got it nice and toasty. I ate it, and then I watched something else when the game was over because I wanted a little bit of joy out of that day. It was a nice balmy 75 in my apartment, too. It was really nice. All that heat coming all the way over from Baltimore.
That was beautiful. I'm going to submit that for a poem because that was just lovely.
I'm just happy that Russ is happy now.
Exactly. I mean, that was great. But I got to ask now, Russ, I know you and I have watched all season. Paul, I know you've got other responsibilities that I guess make it so you don't have to watch football.
Yeah, doctor stuff or whatever. Yeah,
what's wrong with you?
Trying to be responsible and productive with your life.
Why do you need an education? Seriously.
I don't know. I try.
But you and I have watched every game. Is it even shocking anymore when we get down by two scores? I mean, it's almost like Dan Miller and Steve Courtney were speaking on the Lions broadcast this week, and Courtney said, so as the scoreboard say 14-0 Baltimore before the game even starts? Because we pretty much spot teams' points every time.
Might as well. Take 7 minutes off the clock, spot them two touchdowns.
And let's go
from
there.
Let's go. Yeah.
Give us the ball and
let's go. Save me some time.
Yeah, exactly. And so I got to ask because, one, it doesn't shock me anymore, and this is the Detroit Lions, so not a lot shocks me anymore. But two, is it more of one of those things where you're like, we're getting to the point where it's like, okay, fourth quarter, we're down by two scores. Stafford's going to bail us out, but it's not going to be easy. Now, Stafford obviously gets hurt, so that doesn't happen. Are we a team that if Stafford's not healthy, there's 0% chance of anything good happening for us?
Yes.
We have no run game.
Yeah, we have no run. Well, here's a fun stat for you. Stafford, through the air, has accounted for roughly 80% of our yardage.
Yeah.
That's the most, percentage-wise, out of anyone in the league by at least 3%. So we are the most air-heavy production out of anyone in the league. So your question's kind of ominous with his hand injury, right? Going up against Tampa, who's not a good team, but hey, they've scraped out some wins this year. It scares me because we're going to have to rely on a run game that isn't there or whatever he can do with that hand. And I don't know if Paul can give us any insight on what maybe the recovery time or how really available he would be with that hand injury.
Yeah, Paul, you got something for us?
Yeah, I can just dive right into it. So, you know, as you saw, you know, Terrell Suggs, all of, you know, 260 pounds or so of him, stepped on the throwing hand of Matt Stafford in that fourth quarter there. X-rays were negative for fractures after the incident, and then they did, you know, quote, additional medical testing, which I'm referring, or well, I think they're referring to just more X-rays just to see if they any fractures showed up later. The repeat round of testing just confirmed what the initial imaging found, no fractures still. So they reports I saw, they're just calling it a bruised hand. You know, not medical diagnosis of, but, you know, teammates and coaches were calling it a bruised hand. The only thing was that he complained of nerve pain after the event, but, you know, your hand's a small little compartment there. So if you have a big whopping guy like Suggs step on your hand, you know, things, you're going to have some swelling in that hand compressing on those nerves.
Right.
So as you guys already mentioned, you know, he is expected to play and extend his consecutive start streak to 109 games on Sunday. But he, in the light practice that he did have, he had three of his fingers wrapped up. So, you know, he's still dealing with the swelling and the soreness there. So as far as how he's going to do, we can look back at when he dislocated his middle finger last year against the Bears. And his throwing accuracy dipped down to apparently 60.2% and throwing five picks within the four remaining games. I think one of those included the playoffs. So I think he was usually, I think he was like 67% throwing accuracy before that. So he dipped down a pretty decent chunk there. So, you know, obviously we have a lot to fear for how he's going to be, you know, being a Lions fan, we can fear how he's going to actually perform for us to throw us for touchdowns because we can't rely on a running game of any sort. So, you know, we might have to turn to that a little bit more and get our 1 or 2 yards or negative five, whatever we end up getting. And, you know, if you have him for fantasy purposes, don't play him that week because you're not going to get him. You're not going to get a lot out of him. As far as recovery goes, you know, I'm not really too sure what his exact diagnosis is called other than being a bruised hand. So it might, you know, just have to heal up to get back to normal. I don't know. I'm going to take just a shot in the dark guess at maybe, you know, like another week and a half or so.
But, I mean, really so sure. is it not safe to say that we're potentially may have to deal with Stafford having a messed up hand for the rest of the year in some capacity? I mean,
I wouldn't say rest of the year. You know, I don't know what, after it was evaluated, I don't know what they told him, but I would say this shouldn't be too much of an issue because if nothing was broken, and I'm assuming there wasn't any nerve damage because they would have found that by now, even though he had that quote nerve pain. So there shouldn't otherwise be anything keeping him out for the, you know, because he's going to be playing for one, but there shouldn't be anything that's going to hinder him later on once it's, I'll just say, for lack of a better word, feeling better.
All right. So really, until the swelling goes down and the bruises heal up, is this more or less just a pain tolerance thing that he has to deal with?
I would say so.
Okay.
I would say so for sure.
But, I mean, at the same time, you know, you don't get any time off. I mean, yeah, you get a day or two off. But you got to think, he has to do something with that hand, football-related, every day. He's got to throw the ball every single day. So, I mean, wouldn't... not really get it. Like, if they had a bye week, this probably wouldn't be anything of a concern for us because he'd get a whole week to just relax. But he's got to go out there. He's got to practice. He's got to do all this stuff. So, really, he doesn't, for the next 5 weeks, he gets no time to rest that hand in any way. And, I mean, that's got to be a little bit of a concern, especially for Stafford, who has had hand injuries the last 3 years now.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, like Paul mentioned last year, I mean, his accuracy goes down, his interceptions go up with 4 games left in the season because he hurt his hand. Wait a minute. Is that this year or last?
That sounds right.
That's, you know,
I will say, I mean, I can remember, you know, jamming my fingers and all that. You jam a finger on your throwing hand, you don't have control where that ball is going, especially if it's the index or the middle finger, because that's kind of where you're gripping everything. And so, I mean, it's very concerning. But I would like to make on a high point, who would have thought 5 years ago that we would be saying Matt Stafford 109 consecutive starts.
Oh, no.
With how he started his career. I thought he would never get past maybe 2 consecutive seasons of starts without there being a problem.
Oh, yeah. No, he's proven himself time and time again to be just a tough SOB. Just no question about it. Just,
I mean, he's almost like, and his favorite player was Brett Favre. He almost reminds me of the Brett Favre kind of, you're going to hit me. Mm-hmm. This is the game of football. I may be a quarterback, but I'm still a football player. I'm going to get up, and we're going to keep going.
And that's probably when he plays his best, when he gets to be the gunslinger.
Yeah.
Right? And that's in the fourth quarter, when we're down two scores, that's what he gets to do. Mm-hmm. And that's when we see him succeed more.
But I think that's also because we don't get we a lot of Stafford's analysis is on him, but some of it's on how bad this offense is. So I think for three quarters you're trying to run the offense you want to run and handing off the ball, setting up those screens and that. He catches a lot of flack, but the play calling is not on him. In the fourth quarter, you see defenses kind of get a little tighter, get a little more concerned because it's Stafford time. He gets to do what he wants to do. He's out there calling the play as he thinks is fit. And like you said, that's when he shines. So I just think it's time for them to realize, hey, we've got a quarterback who's really good. And my next point was going to be Marvin Jones has stepped up the last couple. And last season, I was more than ready to say, okay, goodbye, go away.
Mm-hmm.
He is right now the best receiver on our team, which is saying a lot because we have Golden Tate, who, in my opinion, is one of the best receivers in the league. So that's why I ask, is this Stafford and Jones finally getting the chemistry, or is this Jones just going, you know, someone needs to step up, why don't I give it a shot?
I think it's just that it's his second year on the team. He's a little more acclimated to the offense. I mean, the thing that got him the contract with us was when he was in Cincy, he was a deep vertical threat.
Absolutely.
Right? And he was great with it, and he was converting a bunch of touchdowns. And we saw that for the first four games his first year. And then he disappeared.
Disappeared entirely.
For the rest of the season. But now it seems like he's fully worked his way in, and we're seeing that more consistently throughout the rest of the year. I think this is who Marvin Jones is this year.
And, I mean, obviously, it's a little weird to compare the two because they're not on the same level at all, but it's a little more reminiscent of he's kind of got his Calvin back, the guy he can just throw it downfield, chuck it up, and say, all right, go get it. And,
right.
I mean, obviously Calvin was the best at doing that. Calvin Johnson's a once-in-a-lifetime receiver. But Jones has shown that. Jones has shown the, you know, he's not like all these other NFL receivers where if you don't put it in the breadbasket, I'm not going to get it. He has no problem swiping the guy out of the way and coming back for it. He's got no problem, you know, oh, you're a little off, I'll cut the route in. And it just reminds me of that. Calvin would go wherever the ball was.
Oh, right.
And I think that's speaking to Stafford's comfort a little bit because last year he didn't do that. He can't do that with Golden Tate. And if you think about it, outside of Golden Tate, we've had a perpetual, you know, wheel of receivers.
Oh, it's rotating it's a turnstile.
Yeah, it's just a turnstile of receivers. There's no consistency.
Oh.
So I think that's helping. And it's a shame that our defense is so bad that we couldn't at least keep him in the running. But two, it's a shame with Stafford's injury. It's a crapshoot. I mean, he could get in on Sunday and go, nope, can't do this. It's just too.
Right.
And obviously, you want him to play, but I would rather have Jake Rudock out there than an unhealthy Matt Stafford because we don't need him getting hurt any worse than he already is.
Right. Just to kind of sing his praises a little bit more. That was a good Baltimore defense.
Yeah.
He set a record. He set a Lions record. With 20 straight completions.
Well, that's why I have it here. 24 of 29 for 292, a touchdown and an interception, 65.5 QB rating.
That part's not great, but I mean, the QB rating anyways.
The interception takes him. But he has a 105.7 rating.
Right. I mean, that's still 20 straight. He completed against a Baltimore defense that's been eating quarterbacks up. I mean, that's the only reason that team's winning games,
yeah,
is that defense. So, he's done better. He's more comfortable. His wide receivers are more comfortable. I think we can finally stop the whole Stafford needs wide receiver help.
Absolutely.
We've got something there for him, finally. We've got two of them. But, man, can we get a pass rush to take the other guys off the field?
But then also think about it. We've got the Jones and Tate thing going well. Ebron has marginally stepped up his game.
He had a decent game against Baltimore.
So I'll say marginally. He's not making me go, oh, wow, keeping him was a genius plan. But at the same time, you hear Ebron pulls it in or Ebron with the catch a lot more than you hear Ebron drops.
Recently, yes.
Yeah, recently, which is a good thing. He's stepping up like we want. But now, knowing that we're I hate using the word air raid, but that air raid, pass heavy. Imagine how much scarier this team is going to be when Galladay gets healthy and gets comfortable.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you've got two outside threats, and then you've got Tate, who, in my opinion, is the scariest guy on our team. And then you've got an Ebron who has proven he can be effective if he needs to be. I mean, we find a running back, we're not that far off anymore.
Right.
So I got to think that this was a really ugly game for the Lions, but at the same time, I see the pieces that would make me think, all right, we're getting there. We're not where we want to be by any stretch, but we're getting there. Mm-hmm. We're not heading in the wrong direction.
No. No, but I worry about with the core of this team how much we can really get there with what's there. Because there's not a ton to move around. Yeah, we need a running back. And yeah, if we found an absolute gem in the draft, that could really change things. Like the year we got Javid Best, we won, I think, the first 5 or 6 games of the year. Started off red hot. You can't bank on finding a gem, though.
No.
Especially not when we have zero history of finding running back gems.
We've had the curse of the running. Like there was the curse of Bobby Lane until Stafford came around. We kind of have the curse of Barry. I mean, I hate to say it, but it's been almost 20 years.
We wasted an all-time talent, so all talents get wasted for all time?
Yeah, pretty much.
We're calling it here.
It's been almost 20 years since Barry left. Mm-hmm. And I got to tell you, we were talking about it before, and don't quote us on this stat, but I'm 95% sure Kevin Jones, who we drafted in 2002, 2003.
Somewhere around there. Back in high school.
Was our last 1,000-yard rusher. Now, Reggie Bush has rushed for 100 yards, which is our new
topic. Yeah, 2013.
Yeah. But no one's come close. Most of our running backs average maybe 500 yards a season, mm-hmm. and that's stretching it. It's just, it's reached the point where a Lion rushing for, Teon Green rushed for 51 yards. That's the norm.
11 carries, yeah, I think.
11 carries. That's the norm right now for us, and we've come to accept it, which is a horrible thing.
Mm-hmm.
I just think running back has to be, and we always, you know, trash our offensive line, but our offensive line this year has proven that they can keep Stafford up, you know, upright for the most part. They struggle in the run blocking, but I think a running back, if we could get that guy that we can trustingly turn around and hand it to 25, 30 times a game, and he'll average 3 or 4 yards a carry.
Mm-hmm.
God help the defenses that have to play.
Oh, it'd be a lot of fun to watch. I think a big problem with that, though, is we can bring in the talent, but if you start off the game down 2 scores, you're not going to get a 100-yard rusher in a game unless you get a 70 or 80-yard rush out of him. Mm-hmm. I mean, game flow is just not going to let you run the ball 25 times or so because you're going to be down 2 scores.
No, I absolutely agree. And it's just, it's very disheartening because every year, if you're a Detroit fan, you don't want to, but you kind of get on that bandwagon of this is the year that we signed this guy. Oh, we got rid of that problem that we had. This might be the year. This could be the year. And without fail, at least since I can remember starting to watch football, the Lions do everything they can to get you right to the mountaintop, and then they fall right back down.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of those things where it's, you really have to ask the question. I'm not going to say, are we going to see a victory? Are we going to see a Lions Super Bowl berth in our lifetimes? I think we'll see a playoff win. I really do. I think we're in the direction that a playoff win is possible. Are we ever even going to see the Honolulu Blue and Silver in a Super Bowl?
Well, I'm in about 15 years, I'm converting my entire body into a cyborg body.
Oh, okay.
So I'm going to be around for the next 300.
You got a chance.
So yeah, I might see one.
Okay.
That might be the only chance.
For us humans, who we have a doctor here that might prove your facts incorrect, I don't think it's going to happen. I want to say it's going to happen. I want to say that one day my dad and I, because if we go to the Super Bowl, I'll buy the tickets.
Mm-hmm.
My dad and I will be able to sit in whatever stadium with a beer and say we got to see the Detroit Lions playing a Super Bowl, because my dad was born the year after they won their last title. So my dad's lived through the entire...
So it's his fault.
Oh, Jeff Dorsch is the stain of Detroit sports.
Mr. Dorsch, you're killing me.
Yeah, I know, exactly. But that I want to say it's going to happen, but the more and more I see it, the more and more I think that's going to be something that I may have to share with my child when he's my age.
Yeah.
Because I don't think we're going to see it in... At least in our parents' lifetime, I guess would be the way to say
right.
it.
I'd like to be optimistic about it, but like you said, we find a way to be optimistic and get crushed every year.
Exactly.
So, yeah.
It's just one of those things. All right, well, we're going to move on. We were talking about the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Cincinnati Bengals. played each other. I got Baltimore on the brain. Cincinnati and Pittsburgh played each other this past week, and it was a slugfest. There were a lot of hard hits, a pretty bad injury. So he's been a little quiet for right now, so we're going to bring back in our baby boy D.O. Rowe, and he's going to kind of give us the news. All right, Paulie.
I love it.
I know you love it. So hit us with it.
All right. So this poor guy, Ryan Shazier, he unfortunately was the victim of attempting to tackle wide receiver Josh Malone, and the crown of his helmet contacted the rib and hip region of Malone, and the hit looked pretty devastating because Shazier was struggling. He seemed struggling to even roll over onto his back as he clasped his hand onto the mid-lower back region in pain, and his legs also appeared to be limp as he made this change in body position as well. But as I heard from, I saw on a tweet per Ian Rappaport, he said that he regained some movement in his lower extremities a little bit after that incident as he was in the hospital. However, that's third-hand now information, so I don't know how accurate that was, because reports are now saying that he recently underwent spinal stabilization surgery. We'll talk about that in a little bit. But there's no indication of specifics as to what his diagnosis is or what his prognosis is. So, you know, all we can do right now is speculate as to what it is. So I'm just going to share what I think it is. This is not anything I've read about what it actually is. But just given his clinical picture there, you know, I'm just going to kind of talk about what might be going on. So I'm speculating that he had a burst fracture. And what that is basically your vertebra, and exactly what it sounds like, it burst from the impact down the spine. So due to the fact that he had apparent neurological deficits after the forceful head-down impact, that also kind of supported my thinking this may be a burst fracture down at the thoracolumbar or lumbar area due to the nerves that come out of those areas and control the muscles of your legs. So what is it? More on this topic. So due to the high energy loading of the spine, because as you saw, his head impacted the side of Malone, and that force translates all the way down his spine. So what can happen from that is at some point, one of those vertebrae can be weak enough and burst. And with that comes a lot of trauma, such as the posterior portion of the vertebral body will burst, and then bone fragments could propel themselves into the spinal cord itself. And then also the disc, which of course, as you may know, may or may not, there's discs in between your vertebra. And when you disrupt the bones, you're also going to disrupt the discs most likely as well. So those discs can protrude into the spinal canal and impinge on the spinal cord as well. So a lot of trauma, as you may have gotten out of that. So how does it present? Well, back pain, for one, and neurological deficits in the setting of this trauma, for example. Most occur at L1, which is lumbar vertebra 1, with 90% of these fractures occurring mostly between T9 and L5, most common, as we said, at L1. I'm not sure if he had just one location, two, multiple, I do not know, but two-level burst fractures are much less common than single-level. So if we're just going to go on frequency here, maybe he just has one level of his spine that, you know, because we're also speculating what happened anyway. So there might be just one level of the spine that had a burst fracture. So all patients require a CT scan to evaluate the extent of the fragments, if there are fragments, and if they entered the spinal cord. And I did see that he did undergo a CT and or MRI scan. And I saw in a report on TV last night that it's based on what they saw, they initially didn't take him in for surgery, but then reports that came in, I don't know, maybe about 2 hours ago at this point or so, they said that he did end up undergoing surgery. But before we talk about that, just a couple more things to discuss real quick. So what could be in your differential, or what other things could this be? Not necessarily as likely as that, but there's something called a wedge fracture, which is an anterior sloping of the vertebra. So the front of the vertebra itself will actually compress and go down. But you see more of that in osteoporosis types of cases, so older people, not people who go slamming headfirst into other players. And then there's also some fractures called chance fracture and butterfly fracture, but we're not going to discuss those because they're very off base to this setting. So with the feared complication of a burst fracture, in the specific location that it may have been in, and also, you know, any trauma to the lower back, pelvis area involving the spine, you are fearing potentially cauda equina syndrome. And what that involves is saddle anesthesia. And that's basically, if you picture yourself sitting on a horse, the area of your thighs and groin that contact the saddle, you lose sensation there. But it's not only as bad, it's so much worse than that. So you'll have bowel incontinence, bladder incontinence, inability to achieve an erection. So everyone's gasping at that point because you can't get an erection.
Oh, please no.
Yeah, there you go. So it's a medical emergency if that happens. So, and again, I'm not saying that this happened. I'm just sharing one of the worst case scenarios that you could also see with this potentially happening. The reason why he underwent surgery, I do not think it may have been that reason. I do not know. But it would be one reason why you would undergo emergent surgery. Because if if you're incontinent in your bowels and your bladder suddenly, that's kind of worrisome.
Yeah, that makes for a bad Sunday.
Absolutely. It makes for a bad life. So let's talk about the treatment. Let's talk about surgery a little bit. So again, one of the reasons why you would undergo the surgery is if there are neurological deficits and or an unstable spine. So an unstable spine, you know, if you had the burst fracture and the actual components of your spine do not make for a whole composed structure. If you have discs that are slipping out and impinging on the spinal cord and bone fragments floating around in your spinal column, you know, that's dangerous, you know, and worse things can happen because of that. And we discussed some of those already. So what do they do for the surgery? You know, there's going to be a lot of rods, plates, hooks, and screws. You're basically, you know, halfway to becoming a cyborg.
Hey, you might live to see the Lions make the Super Bowl still.
Just don't break your back, though. A lot of metal to support that spine and make it stable again. As far as, you know, the human ability to make your spine stable again goes. So there are different approaches you can approach from, you know, anterior, posterior, front or back approaches to the surgery, and the severity of which may dictate which one is used. And the fragments that are potentially propelled into the spinal cord can be removed from a lateral approach because you don't want to disturb the spinal cord any more than it already has been. Again, I don't know exactly the specifics of the surgery other than they were trying to stabilize the spine. So I'm just speculating at what types of approaches they may have used. Since I don't know the exact prognosis and diagnosis for him, I can't really speak to how long he'll be off the field, if he can ever play again. You know, I really don't know. But I think as far as this season goes, I think it's safe to say that he's going to be done for this season.
Well, and that was going to be my question, Paul, is obviously speculating on recovery time and all that, it's nearly impossible because, like you said, you don't have all the information and bodies can react in a million different ways. But with an injury like this, I mean, you got to, obviously this season's over. You got to think the game of football might be over for him because, you know,
it was terrifying.
It was horrifying.
You have to think about that.
I mean, in your opinion, is this kind of one of those injuries that you may have to say that's it?
It's entirely possible because, you know, if you have to have like metal to stabilize your spine in the sport that's so heavily reliant on physical play, you know, it's something to keep in the back of your mind. And, you know, once, you know, we'll see the reports come out when they do about what his prognosis and outlook's going to be like, you know. But it's definitely something to keep in mind.
So just trying to understand this a little more from someone who isn't a brilliant medical mind such as yourself.
Thank you.
Please.
So you had mentioned when you were talking about the burst fracture that could be something where his vertebrae had gotten weak enough before the fracture happens. Is that something that builds up over time from having similar collisions to this, and that it was kind of an accumulation of hits over time that led to such a devastating impact?
Yeah, it could be one or both things. So, you know,
so it could have been spontaneous as well.
Yeah, he could have had maybe a little bit of a microfracture there to begin with to make it weaker, but, you know, the way that the force is going to translate down his spine, that could have just been the exit point for that, you know, theoretical force moving down on his spine, where like that was just the point where it was able to exit at the point and not translate in an efficient manner to the next vertebra. Okay. So that may have been the point where, you know, just the break happened, and that was the unfortunate vertebra that drew the short straw.
Okay, so to draw almost a crude metaphor to it, as you're explaining this, I'm picturing like a long pipe, right? And we're just trying to force as much water through it, right? And it's, say it's more water than it can really take. It's going to break somewhere. This vertebra, I think you said around the L1 is likely where it was. So that was the weak point. So all of that water rushing in, it's got to escape somewhere, and that found the weak point, and that's why we're seeing the injury there that ended up impacting his legs, even though the collision was with his head.
Oh, sure. Yeah, that's a good analogy for it, too, because, you know, have all that water rushing in, and where it finds the point to escape, you know, right at that level, and then that's where you see it.
Okay.
Where it went to, you know, so if you visualize the water as the force, you don't have to sound like Star Wars or anything, but... the force of that impact, looking for that exit point, boom.
Okay.
You know, L1 ends up being the vertebra at risk there.
All right. And
in
we,
most cases.
And we keep throwing out letters and numbers here, and I haven't had to deal with that since algebra. So,
what's algebra?
Oh, no. Oh.
Bad memory?
I'll leave you at the bus stop later.
Thanks, bud.
So, I tried to look up this a little bit to try and be able to have somewhat of an intelligent talk with you. So if we're looking at the L1 and the L5 vertebra, correct me if I'm wrong, those more correspond to your leg muscles, correct?
Yes. So the nerves that come out and exit at those points, they're going to control a lot of the sensory and motor aspects of your muscles and your legs.
Okay. And then the T1 through T12, that's more like your chest and your abdominals, right?
Correct.
Okay. So I think you had said something about your fractures. Most of them occurred somewhere between T9 and L5. So we're really talking core muscles down into the legs is where a lot of that impact. So that could that possibly be why, you know, watching from the stands, it's like, why did his legs go limp? It's because of a vertebrae getting injured in that area of the spine?
Right. So, you know, it's all about where the spinal nerves will exit and then go off to the, you know, structures that they, what's called innervation, the path that the nerves go to and what they control. So just at that level, you know, anything basically below where that fracture, potential fracture happened, everything's in jeopardy from that point below.
Okay.
Because, you know, you have these, you know, everything kind of stems up from your brain, right? So you have all these nerves that are up there, spinal cord goes all the way down.
Mm-hmm.
But wherever those nerves exit, they have, you know, certain objectives, if you will, to go control. So basically anything above that fracture will most likely be okay, because as you saw him, he was able to move his arms visually, you know, mm-hmm. okay. He was able to, you know, put him up to his head because he was in shock of what just happened. But the legs was concerning, because I think that was a good indication as to where that fracture may have been, because you can kind of predict based off of, you know, once you have the neuroanatomy in your mind, you can see that those are probably the structures in jeopardy, and you can kind of predict where that lesion happened, where the burst happened, because everything beneath that is going to be in trouble.
All right. Well, I don't know about you, but I feel smarter and a little less scared of what I watched, because that terrified me. You don't think of guys getting that injury from being the ones laying out the hit. You usually think that's something that happens to you, not that you can do to yourself.
I agree. I do feel smarter, but as you know, there's not a lot of room up there anymore, so I forgot my kindergarten graduation to make room for that.
Didn't miss much. You had peanut butter jelly that day. You're all right.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that memory until just now. So we're going to move on, though. Obviously, a very, very horrific scene. You wish for the best. You hope. I mean, the guy is in his early 20s. He's not been in the league very long. You definitely, I think 2014 was his first season. So you obviously, you know, he's got a long life ahead of him, so you want the best for him. And hopefully he's back on the field. I would love to see it. But in that game, we also saw Juju, I can never say his
name. Smith-Schuster.
Smith-Schuster. Juju Smith-Schuster.
Hashtag Team Juju.
If you want to be on that team, you go for it. just absolutely lay out Bengals linebacker Vontaze Burfict. On, in my opinion, a very dirty, very cheap hit. But at the same time, as Russ mentioned, karma? I mean, the guy lays out people left and right, is nothing but a dirty player. And it's kind of one of those things where it's like, hey, this is what you're doing to people. Do you maybe want to stop doing it now? And
And then, of course, Juju stands over him in a little bit of a taunting fashion, which I think is hilarious because that guy is all of a toothpick.
Yeah, he's he's soaking wet right after Thanksgiving dinner. He might be like 100 pounds.
Yeah, it's hilarious. But this is one of those things where that night or last that night we saw this, guys leading with their head. Obviously, Shazier, Juju. There was a, I don't remember if it was led with the hit, but there or led with the head, but there was a hit on Antonio Brown.
Oh, yeah,
that
George
night.
Aloka. Yeah, that was another head to head.
We spoke about it earlier before we started the show. A couple weeks ago, there was a hit on Joe Flacco from Dolphins linebacker, head to head. Is this a sign of just dirty plays, or is this a sign of maybe people are not learning how to tackle correctly anymore? Because you see more and more people leading with the crown of their helmet, and no offense, not only is it risky for the person you're hitting, but as we're seeing with Shazier, it's risky for you. And I gotta ask, is this something that needs to be corrected immediately? Should there be a bigger, I guess, penalty, albeit suspension or fine, if you start doing this to try to get it out of the league as quick as possible?
I think absolutely. And I think Shazier is actually one of the best examples that we can use, because this is, you need to see what you hit. You need to keep your head up. And you are not only a danger to other people, you are a danger to yourself if you continue this. It needs to be addressed. Pete Carroll, as much as I don't like to give him credit, over in Seattle, he brings in rugby guys in off-season training to teach his guys form tackling without launching yourself into the opponent. Right, and that's a more safe way for you yourself to tackle someone else and to effectively wrap them up and bring them down.
Exactly.
We absolutely need to put a greater emphasis on form tackling, tackling correctly. See what you hit, wrap them up. It's, I don't know, I think part of it is guys like the big violent play because, hey, it catches everyone's attention. And the other one is I can't go low on people.
No.
Right? I mean, and that there's been a ton of emphasis on that, is that if I go low, I'm going to get a penalty for that, especially quarterbacks. So, hey, I'll go high.
Exactly.
Dangerous.
Obviously, we've spoke to my defensive skills on the ice and on the roller rink, so we know in football I didn't have a lot of defensive skills either. I played offense. I had to practice on defense, unfortunately. And I'll never forget, our defensive backs coach, Dennis Hermany, said it best when teaching us how to form tackle. You should hit him in a way so that when you wrap him up, you should be able to tell me what kind of Axe body spray that man has on him.
Yeah.
You should almost be in a bear hug, neck, head to head here. You should be able to tell me what kind of cologne this guy's wearing. And it's true, though. If you're leading with the crown of your head, you can tell me what kind of shoes he's wearing, but that's not going to help.
That's
just a risky thing. And the reason I bring it up is we've talked in the past about this concussion and CTE epidemic. People not learning how to tackle correctly, when you've got a 16, 17-year-old linebacker who's going to go play in Division I somewhere, so he's gonna be an instant impact. When you've got him learning how to tackle incorrectly as a young kid, when he gets to the next level, the competition's even tougher. He's going to have to hit harder. You're running the risk there.
Mm-hmm.
Then he goes on and gets drafted to the NFL, and you're looking at hopefully a 20-year NFL career. I mean, I hate to say it, but we're looking at in 20, 30 years, we could see, you know, our young heroes like Ray Lewis and Brian Urlacher be in some serious trouble because they spent their whole careers hitting so hard. And not to say that either of them were dirty hitters, but it's, you don't learn right. Like, it's the same with, you know, the fundamentals of baseball. You don't teach a kid to throw at another kid because you're running those injuries. You got to teach the fundamentals the right way.
All right. It gets harder to learn it. The higher exactly. and higher skill that
you're
playing at.
You're not going to be able to fix it. And I personally think that what we saw the other night was a little bit of a rivalry. You know, you're looking.
Yep.
And
this game gets out of control almost every year.
They're looking to hit hard. But at the same time, I also think that everyone you saw make a hit is a young guy. And I just think it's a subject of, you know, growing up, you saw Ray Lewis truck someone and take them out of the plate so well that it's like, I want to be able to do that. Well, some people aren't as athletically gifted as Ray Lewis was. So to do that kind of hit or to make the reaction of that hit, you got to cheat it a little bit. And that's where we're looking at these nasty hits that are injuring people are honestly a risk to you as the player.
All right. I think that's 100% what was going on with Juju. I think you nailed that one, that he saw his opportunity to take down the villain of the Bengals defense, right? Exactly. He saw Burfict not looking. He had his head down, and he took his as violent of a shot as he could.
Oh, and Burfict got up and had no idea where he was.
Well, he didn't. He wanted to fight him.
Oh, yeah.
But he couldn't have picked which of the three Jujus it would have been.
And it's exactly true. And, I mean, obviously, Burfict is the villain, but, again, you don't want to see that. Because someone who, even though he does play that villain role perfectly, it's same with, not into the this extent, but Baker Mayfield plays the villain role perfectly. You don't like him, but you never want to see him, you know, right. Something that's going to cost him.
No, I don't want to see any stretchers out on the field.
No.
Like, hey, I'm a hockey fan. I like a fight, right? But, yeah, no, when we're talking about outside of the what should be a football play, you're going too far. There's ways to get them back and strengthen the rivalry without going that far.
Yeah, it's a little tough. It's a little ridiculous. Paul?
So as far as the, you know, Juju hit goes, I guess I can say I like his intention, but not his action. So, you know, I know he wanted to send a message to the guy who usually is the one who ends up putting people in the hospital.
Yeah.
But the thing is, you still got to be classy about it. So for him to stand over him, whether he meant to hit him in that exact fashion or not, you know, to stand over him like that is pretty disrespectful in my book. You know, so if you want to make that big play and take that guy out like that, you know, at least just be, I guess for lack of a better word, just be a gentleman about it. You know,
oh, he was trying to make a statement.
Well, but and you, I guess his cop out could be he's a wide receiver. He doesn't have to hit people very often. But let's be honest,
right.
You know how to make the correct tackle. Somewhere along the way, you were taught the right way to do it.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and you know, and like we're talking about with Ryan Sheehy here too. You know, these guys are at the professional level, so they have a lack of a knowledge of how to tackle appropriately. They're a little bit behind in the fundamentals that should have been resolved a long time ago. Yeah. So I think it's more so of just reckless behavior. You know, like everyone can has the potential to abandon and kind of lose sight of the things that they were taught before. So I think, you know, especially in a game like that, huge rivalry, you know, those things can happen, but they shouldn't, but they do. So there should be, you know, steeper consequences, as we were saying, for reckless behavior like that.
Yep. And then speaking of reckless behavior, we got one more hit that, to me, I'm not going to lie. I didn't know anything about this hit until I went on Twitter and actually saw Russ tweet out about it. And when I saw this, my jaw dropped because I like Gronk. He's a fun player to watch. He has fun off the field. He lives his life the way he wants to. But he shows up on Sunday, and he knows you're not going to beat me. So,
because he's a physical freak.
He is. You're not going to beat me, so I'm just going to go out there and enjoy myself. And he got a little worked up the other day, and after a suspect play, I think there was some contact there, and I think he maybe had a reason to be a little upset. He gets up off the ground, walks along the sideline with a little bit of a Gronk stomp, and then proceeds to power slam onto a Bills linebacker. And he obviously was suspended for one game for it, which I'm not surprised and I actually agree with, but that's the kind of stuff you need to outlaw too.
It wasn't
a quick retaliation. The play was over. This guy was on the ground, wasn't doing anything to affect you. You took your anger out in the wrong time and in the wrong way, and it's going to cost you. Not that New England Patriots are in jeopardy of, you know, missing out on the playoffs or anything. It's the New England Patriots, but you made the wrong decision, and that's going to stick now. Now you're labeled as someone who will make the wrong choice at the wrong time. And for that fact, you're going to get those calls, kind of like the Burfict with the ref. Didn't touch the ref in any way that should have gotten him ejected.
He's got a history of it now.
So, yeah, now it is. Now you're not going to get the benefit of the doubt. But I just want to get you guys' opinion on that hit, because to me it was a dirty hit. It was interesting to see, but at the same time, I don't think there's any place for it in the league.
No, there's absolutely no place. The place there is like you were mentioning, when he went and visited WWE. That's where that stuff belongs. I mean, we talked about the Juju hit. We talked about the Georgia Loca hit. They both initially got one-game suspensions. The same as Gronk, right? Both of them, that was a course-of-the-game action, right? Like, if they move their head a little bit,
it's a safe play.
It's a safe play, right? Still a violent one, but a safe play, and it's within the rules, and it's a football play.
It's a violent game, so yeah, it's expected.
But Gronk, I don't care that he got held. I don't care that someone made him angry, right? The play's over. You see a guy in the most defenseless position that a human body can possibly be in, and he decides, I'm going to hit him in the back of the head. I'm going to jump right into the back of his head. One game isn't enough for me. I need at least two. I can't have that be the same length that the Juju suspension was.
Mm-hmm.
That, I mean, Evans got into a fight earlier in the year.
Yeah.
Got a game. To me, a fight's less offensive than what Gronk just did.
Well, A.J. Green got in a fight, didn't even get suspended.
Right.
Oh, so,
and Tlaib and Crabtree fought each other. Yeah. They both got a game, right? All of them, one game.
Because that's all spur of the moment.
Right.
Yeah.
And it was still in the course of action,
exactly.
Right? Exactly. And it's two willing participants in the case of the Tlaib and Crabtree fight. Gronk attacked somebody who wasn't even looking at him, right? Like, this was shades of Bertuzzi hitting the guy in the back of the head with a stick, right?
Oh, absolutely.
He concussed him.
Yeah.
Right? It was malicious, and it was intentional, and one game as a suspension is a joke to me. If you want to talk about player safety, you have to start by suspending him longer than a game.
Okay, now, I 100% am on the same page with you, and speaking of the Bertuzzi thing is a perfect comparison, because you're at that point, you're not out to, you know, you're actually doing it more to injure the person.
Oh,
there's,
yeah, you're out for blood.
You're out for blood. That's what I was looking for. What's the good course of action there? I mean, you obviously can't suspend him for the rest of the season, because that's a little too, he's not really a first-time offender, but he's a first-time offender in that regard.
Right.
He's gotten in scraps, you
right.
know, in the
yeah,
Super Bowl.
Yeah, but violation of player safety, I believe this would have been his first offense.
Yeah. So yeah. That's what I'm saying. You know, the scraps and all that, it's okay. But
mm-hmm.
So, three games?
Three sounds fair. Anywhere between two and four. It has to be more than one, though, because
Now, but do you, I'm kind of thinking from the side of, you know, giving him the benefit of the doubt.
Mm-hmm.
Do you kind of say, all right, Gronk, here's your one game suspension. We're being light on you.
Mm-hmm.
This happens again. We're going to come down with the hammer. We're kind of giving you that first time. Oh no, you don't do that. You know, a kid steals a cookie from the cookie jar. When you tell him he can't have one, the first time you do it, you don't, you know, smack him upside the butt and send him to his room for an hour. You say, you can't do that. Little slap on the wrist. Well, you think that's what this is?
Well, he didn't steal the cookie. He stole the cookie, and then he winged it at someone's head and hit him in the back of the head with it. Right? If you want to slap his hand, give him two games, and then say you do it again, you're out for four. I mean, that or six, right? Like, this was ridiculous on the face of it. So, yes, it's his first time, and that's probably why he got a little leniency.
Yeah.
But, I mean, we've seen other suspensions for less things. You get two, and then they get appealed. And they go down to one,
yeah.
Right? He appealed the one. Who in Gronk's camp is going, hey, buddy, I think you can beat this? Like, Triple H and Stone Cold Steve Austin were going, I got to take some notes from this guy.
Exactly.
Like, this was ridiculous. Yeah. One game isn't enough.
Paul?
I'm pretty sure that move would be called the People's Elbow, right? Is that what he did?
Pretty
the
close.
The Boston People's Elbow.
Oh, that was
elbow.
That was the Gronk stomp.
Oh,
he got up
goodness.
And was, like, he put dents in the turf as he was walking.
Yeah, you know, so, you know, we're seeing a professional player have a pee-wee temper tantrum.
Oh, exactly.
So when you're acting out of spite, acting out of anger, you're basically going for blood. You're trying to hurt the guy. So I completely agree with the opposition to Gronk, you know, because he got angry, he lost control, and he was ending up, you know, finding himself trying to hurt the guy, because why else would you go after a player who's laying on his stomach, his back exposed to you, and you think of it as an opportunity to do your special move on him, drop the elbow, drop your whole body on him, try to hurt him. But you have no other intention than to try to inflict pain on him at that point.
Right.
You know? So, yeah, I do think he should have had a steeper punishment, at least, you know, three games. I like that number for it, for sure. It can't be in the same line as fighting. Something happens in the spur of the moment. There's not necessarily any, you know, for a matter of time, Gronk was thinking, I'm going to hurt this guy. For fighting, it kind of happened, and there was an instantaneous thought of, I might want to hurt this guy.
Right.
So
there's something build up, and then there's something consensual about a fight, right?
Yeah.
It takes two.
Right.
Yeah.
So Gronk had at least enough time to say, I probably shouldn't drop myself on him right now, but he did. So he should face deeper consequences for his actions.
Yep. Yeah, it underlines how intentional that action absolutely had to be.
I 100% agree with that. It's...
I mean, there's
no room for it.
Yeah, there's a difference. There's a reason why we have a difference between murder and manslaughter, and one of them gets you more years in prison, right?
Yeah,
premeditated or not.
That's true.
I think we know which one this falls under.
That's true.
Robbery?
Yeah, probably.
No, it's,
yeah. But honestly, all jokes aside, I 100% agree. There's no room for this. As I said, I like Gronk. I want to be on his side.
Mm-hmm.
But when you show the flash of that, you also give up an edge. You show, hey, I can get under your skin. And you're, like we said, you're already not going to get the benefit of the doubt. So like these corners, these linebackers who are younger, trying to make a name or know that they're not the impact player that they really need to be, they know, hey, I can needle this guy, maybe get away with one or two little holds.
Mm-hmm.
Gronk's going to get angry, and then guess what? I needle you one more time. You're going to turn around, shove me, or hit me.
You won't like him when he's angry.
You won't like him when he's angry, but the ref's going to look at that and go,
oh, yeah.
I've seen you both being chippy all day.
Mm-hmm.
You, Gronk, went further than you needed to. And Gronk now, he's now labeled as that person who's not going to get the benefit of the doubt from here on out. Doesn't matter if it's like 2 games from now or, 2 seasons from now. He's never going to get the benefit of the doubt again. And I just think that doesn't fit into the Bill Belichick uniform. There is no, weak spot in the armor.
There's no you, there's just the team. Yeah,
but there's no weak spot in the armor.
Yeah.
I just think that there was a big mistake there, and looking back at it after this conversation, I kind of agree with you. The one suspension or one game suspension is not enough for me.
No.
All right, that's going to do it for us on Armchair Sports Talk. My thanks to Russ Ivanek.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Paulie Rowe.
Always a pleasure.
We're not going to thank Justin because he didn't do anything for us today.
Hey, will you just let that go?
I can't.
Just let it go.
It's snowing. We'll go build a snowman. We'll get over it in our differences together. So, as always, try to do better next time. Please leave comments. Let us know what you want to hear. If we miss something, and we'll do our best to get back to you. That's one small step for us, one giant leap back in Detroit sports broadcasting.
What you just said is one of the most insanely idiotic things I have ever heard. At no point in your rambling, incoherent response were you even close to anything that could be considered a rational thought. Everyone in this room is now dumber for having listened to it. May God have mercy on your soul.
Armchair Sports Talk. If your childhood dreams of being an athlete had a voice.